The Detroit Symphony Orchestra has played host to some of the biggest names in the conducting world. But last night, a different kind of celebrity held the baton at Orchestra Hall. As Detroit Public Radio's Noah Ovshinsky reports, this conductor was short in stature and on words.
Osimo is not your typical conductor. It's gender neutral, stands at a little over 4 feet tall. Oh, and it has no pulse. It's a humanoid robot that had its conducting debut last night in Detroit. It walked, yes, you heard me, it walked onto stage to a thunderous applause worthy of Leonard Bernstein. It addressed the audience briefly.
Hello, everyone.
Then gracefully walked to the center of the stage, bowed, and began leading the orchestra in a performance of Impossible Dream from the musical Man of La Mancha. OSIMO, which stands for Advanced Step and Innovative Mobility, is a robot designed and built by Honda. One of its main goals is to get kids interested in math and science. But last night, OSIMO took a stab at conducting. How did it do? David Everson, who plays the French horn, says while OSIMO's timing was impeccable, like a metronome, something clearly was missing.
This thing doesn't have any eyes. You can't see its eyes. They can't convey any kind of emotions to you, you know, other than it's standing up there. It's not moving forward. It's not moving back. It's not making little small gestures or giving anybody any cues.
Leonard Slatkin is the DSO's newly installed music director. Perhaps unsurprisingly, he echoes Everson's analysis. Slatkin says a conductor must be able to improvise, a skill OSIMO has yet to master.
Sometimes you want to take a passage a little bit slower. Sometimes it needs to have a darker color. Sometimes it should be softer. These are all things that a conductor conveys to the orchestra on the spur of the moment.
At intermission, people of all ages were heard talking about and mimicking OSIMO. Janie Degnan plays in a youth orchestra. She says she was surprised by its seemingly human qualities.
I thought he was going to be more boxy, but his head, like the proportions were human-like and his fingers were, you know, yeah.
Janie's brother Kellen is also a classical music fan. He says OSIMO has the technique down, but
a conductor can really convey, like, emotion, and, like, it's not as mechanical. It needs to have energy, and a robot just can't do that.
OSIMO's presence in Detroit, while entertaining, was also meant to draw attention to the importance of music education. A champion of the cause shared the stage with a robot last night. Famed cellist Yo-Yo Ma received an award and performed later in the evening. Although OSIMO seems to be acquiring new skills at an almost inhuman rate, musicians here say that Yo-Yo Ma's job is safe. Conducting is one thing, they say, but a robot has yet to master an instrument like the cello. For NPR News, I'm Noah Ovshinsky in Detroit.
I want to remind you of a moment from the first day of this earthquake when we heard from NPR's Melissa Block, who was there, that people, after rushing out in the streets of Chengdu to get out of buildings that they were afraid would fall, were all on their cell phones, sending text messages. That turns out to be the way that the first word got out about this earthquake in a country where some 600 million people have cell phones. From Shanghai, NPR's Laura Seidel reports.
The earthquake in southwestern China was felt here in Shanghai. The city's ubiquitous high-rises began to shake around 2:30 in the afternoon, and office workers poured out into the streets. Many pulled out their cell phones. This woman, who would only give her surname Li, says she started to text message her friends in Sichuan and quickly learned they were fine. Lee says now many of her friends are living in tents and they can't recharge their batteries, so she sends text messages because they require less energy than a cell phone. Many Chinese needed to hear the voices of their loved ones. Vina Wu Ni works in this large modern office building in the Pudong district of Shanghai. As soon as she heard about the quake, she tried calling her parents up in Sichuan province. She got one phone call through and learned they were safe. But since then, she's been texting.
Because it was very difficult to get the call through, and the signals were very bad. So I started to think, maybe I should try text message. Then I tried to text message my father.
It has been working, and that is how Vina is keeping track of her family. But it's not like Vina wouldn't be texting her family anyway. Like hundreds of millions of Chinese, she often prefers text messages to phone calls. Alvin Wang Graylin is the CEO of MInfo, a mobile search and advertising firm based in Shanghai.
I have an aunt who's 67, and you know that's her preferred way to communicate with me.
According to Graylin, China sends more text messages per user than any other nation.
It's really the preferred way of using your phone. In fact, I'll probably send somewhere around 20 to 30 SMS messages a day, but I'll make maybe 5 calls.
Graylin says Chinese prefer texting for many reasons. It's about half the price of a phone call. Almost no one in China has voicemail, so it's the best way to be certain that someone gets a message.
It's a very practical tool, and it's very easy to use. It doesn't require any fancy phones. It works and everything, and it's very reliable. It's something like 99.9% arrival rate.
Graylin says in China there are even text message-only plans for students. Vina Wu Ni, whose family is still in Sichuan, is happy that she can text her family regularly. But she says even when life is normal, she sends text messages to her father just to tell him small details about her day. Laura Seidel, NPR News, Shanghai, China.
Today, Nissan joined the long list of automakers worried about the weak U.S. economy. It released its earnings report, and along with the warning about tougher times ahead, came a pledge. Nissan CEO said he wants to make his company the global leader in producing zero-emission vehicles, and he wants to do it over the next 5 years. Some industry analysts reacted with skepticism, since up to this point, Nissan has not led the pack in hybrid or electric research. Dustin Dwyer of Michigan Radio has this story on Nissan's aspirations.
Carlos Ghosn is a revered figure at Nissan. Born in Brazil, raised in France, Ghosn is considered the man who saved Nissan from bankruptcy. Today in Tokyo, Ghosn stood in front of a room full of photographers, and he made a simple case for electric cars. He said the number of people buying cars around the world is going up. At the same time, the need to cut emissions is getting more desperate.
There is a perceived conflict between the demand for more cars and the demand for a cleaner planet. 10, 20, or 30% lower emissions cannot be the only answer.
So Ghosn says 100% lower emissions should be the goal. Other executives in the auto industry have made this case before, but when they talk about building zero-emission cars, they talk about doing it a decade from now. But Ghosn says he plans to get a pollution-free vehicle on the road much sooner.
Today, there is latent global demand, but no offer. Nissan has an opportunity to mass market an affordable car that is both independent from oil and environmentally neutral.
Ghosn says Nissan will have these cars on the road in 2 years for government fleets in the U.S. and Japan. He says the cars will be in mass production by 2012.
It feels like a target that I'm not sure they're going to make.
Stephanie Brinley is an industry analyst with Auto Pacific. She says Nissan is far behind Toyota and General Motors in developing a new high-powered battery that's needed for an electric car. But even if Nissan can get a battery breakthrough, Brinley says the company will still have to convince people that electric cars are worth buying.
Particularly with the U.S. market, we haven't been all that accepting of electric vehicles before. So it has to be something pretty darn amazing to really get us to think about it.
It is possible to buy an electric or zero-emissions car in the U.S., but not from a major auto manufacturer. And for the most part, the cars are tiny and they can't go very far. Then there's the Tesla, a sleek two-seater, but its cost puts it out of reach for most consumers. Brinley says to be successful, Nissan has to do better. And she says in the end, what's most important is that Nissan gets electric cars right, not that it gets them first. For NPR News, I'm Dustin Dwyer in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Noah Adams.
And I'm Michelle Norris. It appears Philadelphia's Wi-Fi network is shutting down. It had been held up as a model for citywide internet access. Today, Earthlink, the company that built it, announced that service in Philadelphia is coming to an end. Joel Rose reports.
The Philadelphia network was supposed to help the city bridge the digital divide between rich and poor, while at the same time bringing in thousands of paying customers for Earthlink. But company vice president Chris Putala says the network never delivered on the second part.
When there's expectations of more than 100,000 consumers signing up for a service and fewer than 6,000 show up, we clearly have a network that has not met the real-world proof despite what all the predictions were a few years ago.
From the beginning, the Wi-Fi network was plagued by spotty service and cost overruns. Putala says Earthlink spent $17 million building a system it was willing to give to the city for free. But the mayor's spokesman, Doug Oliver, says maintaining that network could have ultimately cost taxpayers millions of dollars a year.
It's not just the city. No one has been willing to assume that wireless network and the perceived risk.
Earthlink says it expects to pay a $1 million penalty for breaking its contract with the city after talks broke off this week. The company says it will help its customers find other ways of getting online before deactivating the network on June 12th. It's not clear what will happen to the nonprofit Wireless Philadelphia, which has helped hundreds of low-income customers get computers and cheap access to the internet. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose in Philadelphia.
Back now with Day to Day. In Detroit tonight, conductor Leonard Slatkin will give up his place at the podium and his baton to a robot. The car company Honda has a humanoid robot named Ashimo. Ashimo is going to demonstrate its or his, I don't know, musical ear by conducting The Impossible Dream. Celeste Headley reports from Detroit.
You've probably seen videos of Honda's little robot, a shiny white and black figure with a big backpack, walking upstairs, waving and dancing for the cameras. But tonight, he'll step on stage of Orchestra Hall in Detroit, climb onto the podium, and turn to lead the orchestra in a public performance.
There are basically two types of conductors, though, the ones that you want to watch and the ones that you won't watch. And so I think for us, this robot is one we definitely want to watch.
Sharon Sparrow is the second flutist with the Detroit Symphony Orchestra. Her colleague Larry Hutchinson points out that the little robot's namesake, science fiction icon Isaac Asimov, originally wrote the rules of robotics.
And the first rule of robotics is that a robot cannot harm humans. And I was just thinking that I wish more conductors would follow that philosophy.
That's Maestro Arthur Fiedler conducting the Boston Pops in The Impossible Dream from Men of La Mancha. David Ida with Honda says his company videotaped a conductor leading a rehearsal of the piece. Then, engineers programmed the robot to imitate the video perfectly.
Ashimo doesn't have the capability to sort of interact with the musicians and to interpret the different delicate nuances of the music, but it can give you a very accurate rendition each time.
The performance is meant to call attention to Honda's new educational initiative with the DSO. The automaker is giving more than $1 million to create a fund that'll provide instruments and music lessons to underserved kids in Detroit. And music director Leonard Slatkin says that's what matters, not all the hoopla over a cute little robot.
So if you have an automaton doing this, but it ultimately benefits flesh and blood, then I don't think anybody has a problem with it.
Slatkin says this isn't really about a robot replacing a human conductor. Ashimo can't interpret the music emotionally or respond to the musicians.
If the orchestra decided it was going to play a little faster, the robot really can't adjust to that. It just, I assume, waves the stick up and down and the orchestra follows it, much in the same way you would anybody who was not trained in the field. It's a technical device.
But do the musicians think having a mechanical object on the podium is undignified?
I don't think our dignity and our musicianship is that fragile. I think we can afford to have a little fun with it.
And Hutchinson says there's a real benefit to pairing this centuries-old art form with a futuristic high-tech creation.
I think we need to find ways to demonstrate that our art form belongs in this century. And I think it's important that we do things like that, that once in a while we let our hair down and have some fun.
Leonard Slatkin says the robot is really more a kind of mascot than a true conductor. But still,
I'll be happy when Osimo finishes and they will ask to see me again. Yeah, and I get paid more than Osimo anyway. Let's put it this way, I'm not worried about my job.
Osimo's conducting debut tonight will last about 3 minutes or so, and the engineers at Honda must be praying the audience doesn't call for an encore. For NPR News, I'm Celeste Headlee in Detroit.
This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If you live in Wilmington, North Carolina, you get to be an early adopter or a guinea pig, depending on how you look at it. The FCC said yesterday that the Wilmington TV market would be the first in the nation to switch to all digital television starting in September. That's months ahead of the rest of us who must make that switch by February of next year. People who get their TV signal from cable or satellite won't notice the difference, but if you are still tuning in the rabbit ears on that furniture-sized Magnavox or the double-dial Sony, you may need to buy a new set or get an adapter. Joining me now to talk more about the change and what folks might need to do to keep watching is my guest, Megan Pollock. She is Senior Manager of Communications for the Consumer Electronics Association. She joins us from Washington. Welcome to Science Friday, Ms. Pollock.
Thank you.
So tell us what's going to happen. All of a sudden, one day you'll be analog and one day you'll be digital. And if you don't have the right electronics, you're out of luck.
Well, that's the long story short, yes. For a lot of consumers, though, we're already digital. So For most consumers today, they've already purchased a digital television, like 50% of Americans, or, you know, already are watching many of the broadcasters who already broadcast in digital television. So, you know, it's not a real just everything changes all at once. What will happen on February 17th or September 8th, as you mentioned in Wilmington, all of the analog will be turned off. But the digital is already streaming right now, which is great for consumers, but they do need to make sure that if they're watching the analog signal, they know what to do prior to those dates.
Now, when that date comes around, if you have a digital television, you don't have to have a cable box to watch digital on many stations, correct?
Exactly. I think this is something that consumers are less familiar with, that you're going to get crystal clear digital and maybe high definition if you have the set and tune into the right channels on these dates. And so this is great news for consumers.
So you could have your old rabbit ear still hooked up and get high-definition channels, some of them even better than what you get on cable.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be wonderful. I actually watch TV that way now at home. I have a beautiful HD set and get all of my high-definition signals over the air for free.
You still putting tinfoil on those rabbit ears?
Not as much as I used to.
It is a different kind of signal. It's more, instead of fading in and out, it would be more all or nothing, I think.
It certainly is. A lot of the problems with the analog signal does not happen with digital. So ghosting, a lot of the sort of waving in and out and snow that you got with analog, you don't get with digital. Digital comes in crystal clear. So you aren't doing the, stand up in this direction and you'll actually get a signal. And that's one of the huge benefits of the new digital signal.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't, if you have an old television that is analog, is there a way for you to get a converter box?
This is a very simple solution to make sure that your old analog set that you watch over the air television continues to work. It's a digital to analog converter box. It basically translates this new digital signal into analog so that your current TV can still recognize it. Mm-hmm. And these boxes are available everywhere. They're in a lot of big box consumer electronics retailers, all the way down to your local like Walmart and stores like that. So they're available everywhere from about $50 to $70. They're online. They're 1-800 numbers. And really exciting, the government is providing two $40 coupons to help offset the cost of these boxes. So it'll be very easy for everyone to get these and keep using their old sets.
So you can just log on to a website and apply for this coupon and then take it to the radio TV store.
Yes, it's DTV2009.gov. So it's a government website. You go on, fill out your information, and your coupons will be in the mail in the next several weeks.
Well, it's like 5 gallons of gasoline.
Exactly. It's wonderful. It's the best deal in town.
Let's talk about how far can you be from a TV station to get a digital signal if you want to do it like you do with the rabbit ears. Do you have to be close by?
No, it's a lot like it is with an analog signal now. So consumers need to think about if they watch TV now, it's going to be very similar to what they're doing already. We have a website called antennaweb.org. We work with the National Association of Broadcasters on this site, and you can actually type in your exact address, everything about your location, and it will tell you exactly what signals you'll be able to get in the digital world. Huh. And so I think, you know, it does vary. It depends on, you know, do you live in a tower that you're on the 10th floor? Are you in a basement apartment? So, you know, there's really no exact science for it. If you are this many miles from a tower, it really depends on the terrain, on what's around you. So this website will help any consumer type in all of the details it'll ask if you're in a tall building, if there are big trees next to you, and it will tell you exactly what stations you'll get in the digital world.
Let's see if we can help out some consumers. Hi, Tammy in Springville, New York. Hi, Tammy.
Hi. We just got a converter box. We live in an area where the cable doesn't go this far, and we can't get a good satellite dish image. Mm. And when it's coming in, it's great, but when it's not, it's either all gone or it's jarring to watch the pictures just squiggle around.
Yeah, it's all or nothing with digital.
Yeah.
Yes.
And with the analog, you could get the blurry picture at least.
You could at least watch the wavy picture and the snow and everything else. But this, there's nothing if you don't get it.
Well, it's nothing or it just does weird things.
Huh. And you can't get satellite hookup either.
We live in a very wooded area. Unless we're going to deforest this part of New York, no, we're not going to get it.
We're not suggesting that. Go out with the axe. Well, I guess there's some people who are not going to get, you know, be satisfied making it, are there?
Well, I think that, I mean, much like the analog signal that, you know, again, I think she's not saying that she used to get a great analog signal either. That is one of the pieces with digital is it's much more an all or nothing. So, you know, if you were willing to sort of watch this terrible, fuzzy analog picture, the chance that you're going to get a full, crystal clear digital picture is also slim to none. But it is a problem that you're not going to get anything potentially. But you're not typically going to, you know, lose signals that you used to get.
Tammy, how do you get internet connection?
Through dial-up.
Oh, you're still on dial-up.
Oh, yeah.
You don't even have a DSL line. I was going to suggest watching TV.
Well, my son calls us Amish, but with electric.
All right. Good luck to you. Maybe you know what the dirty little secret may be? You're not missing anything.
Well.
All right. Good luck. Thanks for calling.
Thanks.
1-800-989-8255. Let's go to another caller. Tim in Alexandria, Virginia. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
Hi there.
Quick question. I was wondering, I heard that some of the channels are going to have to be changed. I know that they're going to digital, but I mean, I've heard that channels 2 through 13 and anything above 56 will have to be in a new channel. Is that true?
Some of the channels will change numbers because right now what's happened is the government's actually leased both of the spectrum. There's analog and digital spectrum for the broadcaster so that right now they may be broadcasting their analog on the channel that you were always used to, but the digital may be on a different channel. All of that will start to work out as they begin to transition. Your broadcaster is certainly going to let you know. So as you're watching, you're not suddenly just going to be lost. They'll start to rebrand if they're going to start to be on a different channel or move back over. One of the things that we suggest, if you've ever gone through and programmed and had your TV search for all the channels it gets, you may want to redo that just so you make sure. But certainly know that your broadcaster, if they start to change their channel, you know, most news stations sort of have the bug down in the corner. It'll start to let you know, but there will be some movement as the analog spectrum goes back into the government and they're on the all digital. They may change back on their numbers.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. This is certainly not something consumers asked for, did they? I mean, I don't remember a great demand. Hey, we have to have high definition television.
Well, no, and that's not exactly why this all came about. The reason that this is happening, certainly one of the benefits is better picture and better sound to television. This is a much better transmission. The reason this happened really is so that this analog spectrum that the broadcasters have been using for years goes back into the government and has been auctioned off. Some of it's going to be used for public safety, which this is a great piece of our broadcast spectrum. And being able to use this for increased communication will be very very important. We'll also be able to use, they've auctioned a lot of this off, a lot of money has been raised, and all of this has been auctioned off to companies that are going to have new wireless innovations. These are really exciting benefits that go well beyond just a better picture and sound, and that's, you know, that's really why this transition is taking place.
Mm-hmm. And just about any television you buy now is digital, right? You can't, so if you want to, even the cheapest TV that you're going to buy is
absolutely.
So you can't go wrong if you buy any set; it will be
right.
Ready.
And there's some really inexpensive sets. I think people have the misconception that you need to go out and buy a 42-inch flat screen and hang it on your wall. If you walk into any retailer now, whatever TV's on the store shelves, you know, it may look like the old set you used to have, kind of big and bulky. That has a digital tuner inside. So all you have to do is pick up that set with over-the-air, and you'll be fine.
They're confusing high definition with digital, I think, is what the confusion is.
High definition is the best available digital. It's a higher quality digital standard. It is a type of digital television. It's just the best quality. And so it's not required, but it's certainly an option. And we found about 75% of consumers who buy a new TV have purchased a high definition television because, I mean, the picture quality is spectacular.
Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can get one quick call in. Hi, John in Boise.
Howdy.
Hi there.
Hey, we've got a high-definition TV, and we get our signal through Dish, and we ended up having to go buy, we've been through five different digital antennas now because none of the local channels, and I don't think this is true in any jurisdiction, none of the local channels are carried in HD by the satellite providers. And even though we live within a bike ride of downtown Boise, we can't pick up all of the local digital broadcasts. We get maybe 5 of 10 channels, no matter what antenna we try. I'm wondering if the broadcasters are running these on low power now until they make the switch to save money, or what's going on here?
We've got about a minute left. Maybe I can get an answer. Thanks for calling. Are they doing that, running low power? Or?
Yeah, well, I think there will be some changes as they start to run their one digital station at full power. So some may not be running in 100% full power up until February 17th. So you may see a lot of changes between now and then.
Mm-hmm. But there will be that change. What's the date again? We have to
February 17th, 2009, converter box, cable or satellite, or a DTV by then, and you will be good to go. Do it now, and you'll start to receive the benefits of digital.
Right after the Super Bowl, it happens.
Absolutely.
So if you go early, you get ready for that Super Bowl coverage. Thank you very much, Megan, for taking time to be with us. Megan Pollack is Senior Manager of Communications for the Consumer Electronics Association. We're going to take a short break and come back and change gears. We're going to talk about, you know, eating locally. They say you should eat locally and then you would save energy by, you know, shipping the food and whatever. Well, it turns out that if you change your diet, you can do a lot more than by eating locally. We'll tell you how to change your diet and save some of that carbon footprint. So stay with us. We'll be right back after the short break. I'm Ira Flato. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.